Well, as others come in, I'll try to announce when they get here for the record. This morning's schedule, we are going to take up House CS for Senate Bill number 2001, Finance, is the schedule for this morning. Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt the Finance CS for SB 2001 version 24-GS2094/I Bullock, dated 5/31/06, as the working document before the committee.
Any objections? Hearing none, we have the CS for SB, Finance CS for SB 2001 version 24-GS2094/I Bullock, dated 5/31/06, before the committee. It is my intent this morning to walk committee members through the CS, and after that, it's my intent to take a break and come back later this afternoon with amendments. Representative Schultz?
Mr. Chairman, I've just handed a couple of documents. I don't see an attribution on them. I just, as we're dealing with this issue, I hope everything has attribution and that whoever does it will take credit for it as part of the legislative record.
Okay. So I'll make sure that gets put on a representative.
I know it's probably lean Schultz. Times. Letterhead is probably pretty sparse and all those things, but
Some may not have letterhead here.
Well, anyway, I've only been complaining about this through every administration I've ever
worked.
But don't expect to disabuse anybody else of their contempt for our process.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. With that, we will go to presentation. Robin Wilson, Dan Dickerson, and Rob Mintz will walk us through the CS and the changes between the version that we received from the other body and the version that we have before us, and we'll answer questions in regards to that. So with that, Robin, did you want to start?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robin Wilson. I'm the director of the Tax Division. And so what I will do today is to walk through first the matrix that you have before you, which highlights the key differences among the bills. Not all of the small differences, but it's intended to highlight the main differences. And then I will walk through the bill and point you to the sections that have been changed. Ready to go?
Okay. And for the record, Representative Jewell has joined us. Also for the record, Representative Moses is excused for the day. Robin, go ahead.
Yes. I draw your attention to the matrix before you. It's got a number of columns. And what I will be highlighting for you is the last column, which addresses the CS that we're working on. And I will highlight the differences between this CS and the version of the bill that passed out of the House during the regular session. That is the second column of the matrix. And also the what was passed out of the Senate recently, that is the fourth column. So those are sort of the columns that I'll be focusing on the matrix. Okay, then moving on. First and foremost, I believe that the tax rate in the CS is 20%, and that is compared to the previous House version, which was at 21.5%, and the Senate version, which was at 22.5%. The next significant difference has to do with the treatment for the Cook Inlet oil and gas. For the Cook Inlet oil, in previous versions, what you saw was a revenue exclusion, a value exclusion, actually, which was sort of started with the GRE or gas revenue exclusion, but it was that treatment was carried over to Cook Inlet oil. And so in previous versions of the bill, what you saw was a three-quarter value exclusion for Cook Inlet oil. That sort of that sort of grew. I will point you to the language in the previous versions, but that whole section became kind of confusing, and I think what the sponsors of the CS are looking for is to sort of simplify this presentation. And so cooking oil in this CS is being handled the same as cooking gas was in previous versions, and that is to look at the PBT tax on Cook Inlet and then compare it to what would have been paid under the ELF system for Cook Inlet, and the tax would be the lower of those two. And so consequently, Cook Inlet oil line, you'll see the changes, and then Cook Inlet gas is the same in all those columns. Okay, the credit rate remains at 20%. That's true of all the three versions that we're talking about. Private royalty rates remain the same. The GRE, that is the gas, it was called the revenue exclusion. Technically, it was the value exclusion. That goes away in this version, so it's noted as not applicable. The next item is progressivity. And in this CS, progressivity kicks in at $45 per barrel net value, and the slope is 0.00175, that is 0.175% times the net value. And we'll compare that then to the House version that passed out in the regular session, which had a trigger of $35 net, but had a 0.25% slope. So the slope is lower, it kicks in a little bit higher. If we compare it to the Senate, that progressivity kicked in at 35 barrel net, but it had a slope of 0.001 or 0.1%, so that had a lower slope. And as we walk, when we get to walking through the bill, then I'll go through the chart that you have that doesn't have Department of Revenue on it, for which I apologize.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm basking in sincerity.
The progressivity tax cap on all versions is 50%. That is, you take the regular tax rate, add it to the progressivity, and the total cannot exceed 50%, so that has not changed. There's no gas progressivity because the progressivity is on net. And as is true with all of the versions there that I'm highlighting, the progressivity is not deductible. The committee has maintained the transition provisions, that is a 5-year look back, 2-for-1 on the capital expenditures. This 20% credit and no oil price test, and that is a 7-year rolling sunset, so that all remains the same. Base allowance has been changed a little bit. You will recall in the Senate version, that $12 million credit was not based on production. And so in this version, it is based on production, and that is the same as what came out of the House in the general session. 10-year rolling sunset on the base allowance, and again, that has not changed. Safe harbor has not changed. And the treatment with interest has not changed. The effective date is the same as the versions, that is April 1st. And we've got a 10-month transition period that's been clarified a little bit, and I'll highlight that when we walk through the bill. There's been no change to the spill surcharges or the treatment. And there's been no basic change to the SB 185. abandonment. We've adopted the further improved language that was in the Senate version, and I'll highlight that as we go through. There's no changes in how the credits are usable, nor the transferability has not changed. And the refundable credits are refundable up to $25 million depending on investment in the production limit, so that has not changed. The credits for the annual loss, I would highlight that just as being, that is the net operating loss that is carried forward, then is converted to a credit at a rate of 20%, which matches the tax rate as it should. And that's just a change from what the Senate passed out, where they adopted a tax rate of 22.5 and so converted losses at the same rate, 22.5. I would note just on that same line, in the House version that was passed out in the general session, the House had a tax rate of 21.5%, but the annual loss conversion was not changed. I believe that was, well, I think there was some discussion maybe at the last minute, but in effect, the conversion rate for the annual loss should match the tax rate. It should be the same rate. So that has been achieved in this CS. There were no changes then to point of production language, nor the DNR royalty value usage. So there's no provision for the use of the RSA's core value, and that has not changed. The 482, Section 482 from the Internal Revenue Code, that usage has to do with transfer pricing audits, and that same language has been in the last several versions, so that has not changed. Oil spill, cleanup costs, the language has been changed slightly. There's an exception for the gravel pad, and I'll highlight that again as we go through the actual bill. DNR gets expiration data. What that is the expiration credits that are claimed. The producer then must give the information to DNR, and that's the same language that was in the SB 185 credit. So that's been adopted, and that provision has remained the same through the last several versions of this bill. The NPSL regulations after industry practice, that was the sort of the hierarchy there of direct costs. And in the House version that was passed out during the general session, it was more general. The Senate adopted some slightly modified language to restrict it to in Alaska only. I will highlight that when we get to it, and this CS adopts that language. The FERC, the credit flow through, FERC regulated facility, that same language has been maintained, so there's been no change there. And there was a high energy fund established in the House version that was passed out during the regular session. That language was removed in the Senate version that was passed recently, and so it is not in the it's not included in the current House CS before you. So that kind of summarizes again just the key high points of the changes. And what I'd like to do now is just kind of go through the bill quickly, highlighting the places that you should take a look at as being changed. Moving on then, I'd like to flip over to page 3. Section 5 of the bill, line 9, is where we find the tax rate of 20%. And there's some, and I'll invite Mr. Mintz to contribute information about the technical drafting Did you have a comment on that paragraph?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Robert E. Minson. I'm working with the Department of Law on production tax legislation. I just point out that, as Robin mentioned earlier, one of the changes in the committee substitute is to have the same type of cap on the tax for Cook Inlet oil as is currently present for Cook Inlet gas. And so on line 8 of page 3, where it says, except as otherwise provided, it says under I and J of this section, and J, as we'll get to in a minute, is the new provision that provides for a cap on the tax on Cook Inlet oil. I already provided for that for Cook Inlet gas.
Okay, then flipping over to the next page, the progressivity section starts on line 3. And so on line 9, we see the slope of 0.175. On line 13, we see the 50% cap, which I mentioned as being the same in the later versions. And then on line 16, we see that the trigger point of $45, and that's on net. Now a couple of changes I'd like to highlight here. In subsection H, what we've done is we require annualization of the lease expenditures for purposes of calculating the progressivity. And the reason for this is that when you look at progressivity on a net basis, then the timing of expenditures becomes critical. And so there's some room to play with that. And so this is a solution that was put forth to mostly alleviate that concern. There's, you know, still will be some flex in there, but what we've tried to do is restrict it so that if expenditures vary very much from month to month, then that will be taken into account there on an annualized basis. So that's the proposed fix for that potential problem. The other thing I wanted to point out is that, and you will be seeing, I expect, an amendment tomorrow or later this afternoon, I'm sorry, to correct the progressivity should be calculated on basically barrels of equivalent based on an energy basis. So this was a drafting problem, and so you'll see a correction for that tomorrow. This afternoon. So I would like now to draw your attention to the graph that you have.
Mm-hmm. Could you just invite Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kelly?
Thank you.
Yes, if I could invite Ms. Mintz. Yes, that specific drafting language that wasn't taken into account there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kelly, at the bottom of page 6, this committee substitute draft has a new subsection which defines barrel of oil equivalent. Actually, the intention is to have two different ways that that's defined depending on what subsection we're talking about. One of them is based on cubic feet and the other one is based on energy content, so we'll be trying to fix that.
And that's the fix you were talking about yesterday, or the problem on the button. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, the graph before you then has three lines, and what it seeks to show you is based on the ANS West Coast price, how the progressivity line lies for each of the three versions that I've been talking about. So the CS before you is represented by the blue line, that is a slope of 0.175% triggered at 45 net per barrel. The yellow line is what came out of the House in the general session, and that is a slope of much higher slope of 0.25, but it kicks in at a lower net value. And then the third line is the Senate, And that's the red line. That's at 0.1% slope starting at 35. So you can see that the CS that is before you is sort of the moderate approach between these two other options, the Senate being the lowest liar and the House version being the highest.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robin, I'm just curious that at today's oil prices, say $70, you know, obviously we have a higher progressivity rate because we have a lower tax rate, 20%. The Senate has a higher tax rate, 22.5%, but they have a lower progressivity rate. So at today's dollar price, which one is bringing the most to the government, to us? Eric, you can get back to me. Thank you.
For the record, Representative Waterrock has joined us. Representative Guerra and Representative Berkowitz. I think that's all for right now, so go ahead, Ron.
Representative Meyer will be, we will be getting that information to you.
Good.
Okay. Any further questions on the progressivity graph? If not, I'll then keep going through the bill. Okay, we're still on page four.
If it's in.
And I would direct your attention to starting lines 22, and that is subsection I. That is the Cook Inlet gas tax cap provision. And that goes on from page 4, line 22, through page 5, line 8. And then immediately following, that is starting on line 9, you see the similar provision on the Cook Inlet oil. And so those two sections just basically duplicated. Going on then to line 27 on that same page 5, this is a new section, a subsection that explains how Cook Inlet credits are applied. So that the tax test is done before credits. CBT tax is calculated along with the progressivity on Cook Inlet, and it's compared to what would have been charged under ELF. The lower is taken, and then this explains how credits are taken into account then and applied. And it was felt that if a producer gets a break on the tax rate from PPT down to ELF in that particular price scenario, that it wasn't necessarily fair then also to get the benefit of those extra credits. So this section then explains how the credit carry forward is reduced by that credit amount.
Representative Cotrillo.
Could you just go over that one more time for us, especially how the credits are not going to happen, please?
If there's a scenario where the PPT tax is higher, let's say, and then the ELF is lower in that scenario, the producer is getting a break on the tax and would have consumed more credits under the PPT. And so it was felt that getting sort of the benefit of all those credits along with the tax break was not fair or consistent.
So it would have brought it on down even lower than what it would have been under the old ELF?
Correct.
So there's kind of a floor, Mr. Chair, is that all right? So there's kind of a bottom. Is that right?
Yes. Mr. Dickinson has a specific presentation on Cook Inlet.
Right.
which I think may answer some of your questions. And at the pleasure of the chair, we can do it now, or we can do it when we've finished with the walkthrough.
That's correct.
Do it now, or when
we'll do it after you finish the walkthrough. Then we'll come back and pick up what you put together on the curriculum.
There's two different ways they calculate.
Robin?
Okay. I would note there's a couple of grammatical word changes that you will, I expect, to be seeing an amendment for on line 7, 9, and 10. They'll just be one word changes, but I'll just highlight those. Because right now it says the amount are, and it should be the amount is. And on line 9 it says limitation under I of J, it should be I or J. And on line 10, tax levied under, and it should be tax levied by. So those will be three minor word changes that you'll see in amendment 4 later. The next, draw your attention to subsection L. That is lines 22 through 27. There was a little bit of a drafting issue in here as well, and so you will be seeing an amendment later today. What happened was there were two, and I would invite Mr. Mintz to jump in here, but there were two parts of this that talked about regulations adopted by the department, sort of combined the drafting and
drafting. Four dozen. We will take those over 2 days. They don't get stale.
Bruce Collins,
and
that's one.
Bruce Collins.
Good job, Bruce.
Okay. Robin, please go ahead.
Okay, next I would draw your attention on same page 6, subsection M, lines 28 through 30. That is new language, and that just talks about this barrel of an equivalent that is to be measured on energy units. And so this language then establishes our authority to write regulations establishing those sampling and testing methods. Okay, then moving on, page 9. This is not a change, but I would just highlight that the basic credit rate of 20% is on line 8 of that page. And
Mr. Chairman, if I could jump in here, a little bit of a technical matter, but I'll just bring it up because it is a change. On line 10 of page 9, where it used to say makes an election under 160F, and now it says makes a substitution under 160F. Now, the committee will recall that 160F basically provides for a producer to either deduct actual lease expenditures each month or to annualize lease expenditures and deduct 1/12 of the calendar year lease expenditures. As Robin explained, because of timing problems with the progressivity calculation, for progressivity purposes, the producer is required to annualize, and therefore, if the progressivity tax kicks in during a year, it's not an election, it's actually a requirement. So that's why we changed the term from election to substitution.
Okay, and you'll see that several places in this section. We're flipping over then to page 10. Line 5 is where you will see the credit conversion of a net operating loss, and that's at 20%. Okay, and also within that section, there was a phrase taken out, and let me just, forgive me just a moment. And the phrase was, may be applied irrespective of whether the producer explorer also claims a credit for transitional investment. There was a question raised about that, but it wasn't clear what it meant, and so it was taken out. And if you look at the the Senate CS 2001, I would refer you to page 8, line 23 and 24 for that, for the language that was taken out there.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just expand on that. This deletion is not intended to change the meaning or effect of the bill. Basically, the language that was taken out is really superfluous, and I think it caused confusion, leading some people to think that there was some kind of overlap between transitional investment expenditures and lease expenditures. So we hope that it will just eliminate that confusion by deleting the superfluous language.
Going over then to page 10, section F, which starts at line 12, that's what talks about the refundable credit. And then if you look at line 15 to 17, that's where the production limit is found. Did I say page 10? I meant page 11.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's not on to you.
The next change I would like to highlight is on page 20.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robin, on the $25 million, you didn't talk about that, and I guess it's not a change, but in regard to Dr. Van Meer's memo yesterday or a couple of days ago, I just saw it yesterday, on the $25 million being something that could cause problems, and we've talked about that before in down oil price time. Did you guys take a cut at that at all in the CS at solving that problem that he talked about, or do you disagree that it's a problem, or is it a policy call, or just before we whiz by that, I'd like to know on that.
I'll tell you through the chair. No, I mean, I think we, the administration has said that they are not comfortable with this particular clause, but it's something that has been in various House versions. I mean, we've always said that this should remain within the PPT, the credits, the ability to carry forward or monetize them, and essentially in allowing a deduction, a direct repayment, is the same. Those revenues have to come from someplace, i.e. they'll have to come from income tax or other sources of funding. So I think Dr. Van Meer has reflected the administration's general view that those aren't necessary. We understand that the folks don't. If you leave small producers to sell their credits, they may only be getting 90 cents on the dollar. The notion is, well, the state should pay the full amount. But I think Dr. Van Meer has identified, we have previously the situation you described, which is where these may be used only in a situation in which the state may not have extra cash as well. You know, how will come about that appropriation? Those are kinds of issues.
Representative Kelly.
So it is a policy call, I understand, but it was I just wondered if you'd taken a look at that. I'm wondering if it might at least be worth considering. I know that's for amendment time, but considering just wiping that out and saying, scramble out there, guys. Do what you can with them. And that brings up the Seton's idea of the arm board thing in some way if we were going to keep them, but that kind of went down the path. So maybe we'll look at that a little bit later.
Yeah, and I can say that, we didn't really dig back into that issue. It was in the House version when we passed the House version. It was in the governor's version A whenever he reintroduced it. It stayed in on the Senate side, and we left it alone because there was no real complaints about it.
If I can just one quick follow-on. So he is not as in love with that as he once might have been, keeping it out of there. Has there been a change in
it? Representative Kelly, through the chair, I would say that this is not a key issue of the PPT. The governor was focused on the key economic issues that what this represented. This is a administrative issue, it raises other questions, and I would just say it's not part of the major focus.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Kelly, through the chair. You know, the more potential refund there is, the more risk. And I think if we look back at, and I don't have them here in front of me, but I think maybe the original idea, as I recall, was a $10 million limit on the refund. And so sort of a matter of degree of risk.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember which version it was, but it was in one of the versions.
I didn't agree with everything Dr. Van Meers said in that memo, but that was one of the things that looked like he didn't think he got a lot for, and it could be a problem. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Rob?
Okay, moving on then to page 20. On line 28, that begins section 160. Which is what determines the production tax value. And I'm just drawing your attention to that because that is the section where the GRE or the gas revenue exclusion or the gas value exclusion was. It has been taken out of there. So it now what 160A does is to simply require some separate accounting, cook inlet oil net value, cook inlet gas net value, remainder. And that's because in 011, if you recall, we have the tax test, the ELF test, and so this section then simply clarifies the accounting of the net value. On page 22, subsection C, I would just draw your attention, starting with the lines 6 through 14, we've clarified, we have not changed, but we have clarified and changed word order regarding ordinary and necessary. And what it did say was direct and ordinary and necessary. There was a lot of discussion about commas and what was modifying what and so on. And so the goal here was again, sort of to clean up the language and make it more clear and not induce the ire of the English teachers. And so you will notice then just some word order changes. And Mr. Mintz, do you have anything to add to that?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I guess basically the technical problem is there were three words but only two concepts, because ordinary and necessary is kind of a single concept, and there's a lot of controversy about commas, ands, and so we're just separating the two concepts and putting them in different places so we just avoid that controversy. Now, I'll point out that there was a drafting error lines 12 to 14, which will be fixed in an amendment, because that repeats the direct and ordinary and necessary language we're trying to get rid of. And we're proposing just to substitute for those three lines basically lease expenditures. So we'll say, in determining whether costs are lease expenditures, the department should give, etc. And that will avoid these grammatical controversies. But before we leave page 22, one other clarification on line 31. This is not intended to change anything, but to clarify the existing intent. And this is paragraph 2, which says, in certain circumstances, the Department of Revenue may allow a producer to treat the costs that are billed under an operating agreement as that producer's lease expenditures. And what we're adding here is the phrase, other than items listed in D of this section. D of this section is a list of items that are not allowed to be deductible lease expenditures. And this is just to make crystal clear that even if an item on that list were billed under an operating agreement, it would not be allowed to be deducted.
Okay, moving on then to page 23. I just note on line 17, there should be a comma after oil and gas. And so I expect you will see that as a small item on an amendment later today. Page 24. Page 24 is the list of things that are not deductible. And on lines 28 to 31 and then on to the next page is where you will find the discussion about abandonment. And that is substantially the same language you've seen before, except if you look then on page 25, lines 11 and 12. 10, 11, and 12. And what this says is a cost is not excluded if the abandonment or if the removal is undertaken to replace or renovate or improve. And the thinking, I believe, is that the original intention to disallow the abandonment cost was actual plugging abandonment, but not to preclude the expenses when it was really for the purpose of improving. And Mr. Dickinson, do you have anything to add to that? Okay. So that is the new language there on those last couple of lines. Then on the same page 25, item number 17, which is lines 13 through 19, that is the oil spill language that disallows expenses regarding uncommitted oil discharge. And the new language is found on line 14 that is not confined to a gravel pad. And as I understand it, the thinking on that is that there may be the half a cup of oil that's contained within the gravel pad, and those sort of immaterial expenses, the accounting for them would vastly outweigh the benefit of disallowing them. Any significant oil spill of any amount is expected to exceed the gravel pad. So that's sort of a materiality barrier, I guess, if you will.
Question on that. Is there a definition of gravel pad, or how are we going to define what the gravel pad exactly is?
Through the chair, there is not a definition in the statute. I think that would be something that would be defined in reg. I think 95% of the time it would be clear. Clearly there are some places where, you know, is a road a gravel pad or something like that.
You had any discussion with DEC to check what the, you know, about this? I mean, I'm just kind of concerned about how big gravel pads could get and how many barrels could actually go into a gravel pad.
Lieutenant Petrullo, through the chair, we have not, and you know, when you go into the regulations, we definitely would. I think the notion here is that within a gravel pad, there is a containment system set up. So what we're talking about on line 15, it says we're looking for where costs exceed the routine costs of operation. And so I think you have sort of the normal containment mechanisms in place there. And the notion is this would be something that would exceed that. Not visualizing fill up a gravel pad with spilled oil, but the notion really ties to that idea of routine.
Okay, I'll read the section better. Thank you.
Moving on then to page 28. And there I'm looking at section 170. 4355-170. That is the base allowance section. And if I direct your attention then to line 10, that is where the production limit is found that was added, and I mentioned it as I went through the matrix. Lines 10 through 19. And then I believe lastly, if I could turn your attention to page 35. These are the transitional provisions. And I would direct your attention to line 6 and 14 in particular. And these sections in previous versions of the bill talked about a 10-month transitional provision where a producer would pay under the old system for that period of time and then have to true up and pay up the PPT that would have been due on for those months in the 10th month. And there was some question about what does 10 months mean if this bill is effective, effective retroactively to April 1st, but technically it is, the bill is not effective until you know, the governor signs it after the legislature passes it. And so if that happens in mid-June, let's say, then what does 10 months mean? So this language that was added seeks to clarify that, not to change it, but to clarify it. And so the 270 days is roughly 9 months. And so the language says before the first day of the first month that begins at least that point after. So that seeks to give definition to the 10-month rule that was in previous bills. And then the 300 days that's found on line 14 is the equivalent of 10 months. Do you have further information on that?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of ambiguities that we were attempting to fix here. First of all, if you counted out the months and the days, it looked as if the idea was to have a 10-month period of transition under which the producer would continue to pay according to the old system, and then after that, the next month would true up under the new system. But it looked like the last month for filing under the old system was also the same month for truing up under the new system. So that's why we have 270 days for the old system, and then the new system true up starts after 300 days. Now the question is, by going down to 270 days, have we reduced the transition period from 10 months to 9 months? I don't think so, and the reason is this, because the tax and the tax return are due at the end of the month after the month in which the oil and gas is produced. So we have 9 months of oil and gas production that are subject to the old system, and you have an additional month for filing that last return. And you have one more month to do the true-up. So I think it works and accomplishes the goal with a little more clarity. And there are a few other technical changes in the language which are not intended to change the meaning, but also to make clear what we're trying to do. And I'm referring to several provisions where the old language talked about you pay the true-up amount on what was unpaid from the transition period. And really, it's not a question of what was unpaid, but what was not due during the transition period. Because if it was due during the transition period and wasn't paid, it still has to be paid and with interest. It's a technical change. I think it's more accurate. And if there are any questions after the committee's had a chance to look at the details, of course, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's kind of a broader inquiry. You know, before, when we were in regular session and we had this bill in front of us, it was without the benefit of a gas contract, having had seen a gas contract. Will you, the administration, or our consultants be able to put this piece of legislation in context of the gas contract? Will we get that? And the reason I ask that, and I think this is the place to do it, is once this bill moves from committee, we won't be able to draw on the expertise that's available to have that discussion, and this is the only place that we can have that discussion.
Representative Jewell, through the chair. the answer is yes, that what you see here, or what is in the contract, is basically a bulking in of what will pass out of the legislature. What you see in the contract is the governor's, the bill that he submitted in the special session. But I think we have made very clear that if the legislature acts and does something different, changes those parameters, that we're going to have to go back and insist that those parameters, the changes, then be reflected in the contract. Because we understand that you don't intend to go through this exercise for the fun of it and then see something different in the contract. So what the whole idea behind fiscal stability on oil is, take the existing system, the system that you're creating and crafting right now, and then create stability on that. So if you took the bill that's before you now, the CS, and compared it to the contract, you would find differences, but they'd be precisely the differences that have been identified as the difference between the governor's bill and the CS in front of you.
Okay, I'm not sure what your answer was. Was your answer yes, we'd be able to get that in context, or we can draw those conclusions on our own?
We are creating, I don't believe it's on the website yet, but we are creating a comparison between existing statute and the introduced legislation and the contract, basically what's in Exhibit P of the contract, and a comparison, and we'll be glad to get that to you. And we may go through the exercise of updating it for a particular CS, if that's appropriate.
Representative Whiterock.
On that point, don't we achieve the fiscal certainty by taking this, putting in the gas contract, and then having a sunset date on this every 3 years so that the long term is incorporated in, but the legislature still isn't bound by the 30-year term of the contract without changing it?
Could you repeat the question?
I'm not sure. In other words, if you put this in the contract and it binds the state to the long term, the gas contract, but this has a, say, 3 to 5 year sunset date, then you still achieve the long term security and the legislature still has the opportunity to review.
Representative Whiterock to the chair. This, like any other legislation, has no shelf life at all. I mean, you can call yourself back into session and change that. The contract will bolt something into place, and it will bind the parties to the contract. It won't bind anyone else. If as time goes on, adjustments are appropriate for taxpayers that aren't part of the contract, you'll always have the freedom to do that through the normal legislative process. The fiscal stability will just be for the signers.
You may have missed my point, but I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Before we leave the sort of section by section, I would I did fail to draw your attention to page 24. Could we look at that? And there's just two changes there I'd like to draw your attention to. This again is the list of expenses that are not allowed in calculating net value. So I draw your attention to line 9, and that is the costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. That is the same language that was passed out of the Senate, but it is different from the language that was passed out of the House in the regular session, and the change is the addition of the word gross before negligence. The thinking was that the gross negligence is more in line with the first two items on this list. Fraud, willful misconduct, and gross negligence all sort of imply a high degree of misconduct, if you will. So that's one change on the page. And the other change on the page is found at line 29. What it says now is abandonment of a well pad, and it used to say well. That the well pad language was found in the Senate version. It is a change from the House version. So that addition of pad right after well, thinking that wells are capped all the time, but what this, the intention of this paragraph, we believe, is to address total abandonment of actual well pads. Mr. Dickinson, do you have any further information on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I might. The typically in operations, people all the time are P&A plugging and abandoning wells, or they'll do a sidetrack and they'll cement that piece in. So just in the normal and routine operations, wells are continually being reconfigured, and there's some sort of abandonment element to that. The notion was we didn't think that this is what folks had intended to look at. What folks I think had looked at is when operations have truly ceased in an area and folks are packing up and moving out of that area, that's when these provisions would apply. So what we didn't want to do was get into an audit issue where we had to go in and say, there's 32 wells on this well pad, and they're not using this one. They haven't used it for 2 years, so now we need to go in and figure out what the costs are and those kinds of things. So we think this is just really in line with what people had in mind and still preserves the special rules for true abandonment, but doesn't insert them into normal everyday operations.
Okay, and I believe that concludes my walkthrough of the bill. As I said, Mr. Dickinson has a presentation on cooking, but if there are no further questions, okay. Anybody?
Any other questions before we move on to cooking? Seeing none, yeah. Proceed, please.
Thank you. What I'd ask people to do on this is turn to the second page, which is a spreadsheet, and I'm really going to walk through several scenarios, and there's 2 points that I'd like to make about Cook Inlet and what's happened there, as folks have looked at it. What this second page does is it simply compares the effect of three items that have been built into various versions of the bill. All three of them, I think, were focused on small producers or on Cook Inlet operations. And I wanted to show what the various effects of those pieces are. And one of the things that I have tried to articulate to folks, and I think the CS reflects it, is that we had three tools, and they sort of all did the same job. And so when you put all three tools together, the job got overdone, if you will. So, I think this bill, this CS solves that problem, and has solved it, incidentally, by basically going to the middle column, the tools available there. All the backup numbers for the spreadsheet are found on the next to the last page of the packet. I'm not going to walk you through how I did all those calculations. I certainly can if folks have questions. What we've done here is run four scenarios. If the Cook Inlet gas value, and again, I'm taking an average value, folks are going to react differently depending on whether they're above or below average. This is really meant to be an overall picture. Run it at $2.50, at $4.50, and the $4.50 essentially represents the values that we've seen for about the last year. I think it's more like $4.72 is the official value that you'll find on our website. But that gives you a good sense of the status quo. I think in general, folks view that gas prices in Cook Inlet are rising, primarily because contracts there are beginning to be tied to world markers or U.S. domestic markers. And so I ran scenarios at $6.50 gas and at $8.50 gas.
I think the point, if you look at the first
set of three columns, which is the effect of a two-thirds GRE or gas revenue exclusion. The three columns do in each case, the first column says, what is the change that would occur relative to the PPT base? So as a normal administration, how much would the dollar effect be of that particular tool? The second column says, how much actual tax would get paid? And then the third column indicates how much change would there be relative to the status quo taxation. So starting in the upper left-hand corner, what you can see is if the gas revenue exclusion came in and prices were what they looked like historically for the last decade or so, back when they were in the $2 range, there would be a negative tax due gas revenue exclusion, and I think that generally makes sense. Their costs are in at full bore, revenues are greatly reduced. And so what you'll see is there would be a significant, a tax of negative $26 million in the Cook Inlet. And let me back up here. What I've done is I've given five examples, a high volume field that has high ELFs, a big volume that has low ELFs, someone that's in a mid-range, then I've looked at a small volume producer that tends to have an average low ELF, and a small volume producer that tends to have a high ELF. We remind folks that in the Cook Inlet, the ELFs are variable. They range from a high of about 0.75 or 0.8 down to zero. The average ELF is about 0.5. And so, depending on what field a producer has production from, their ELF can be very different, and hence their tax rates can be very different. What I'm going to really focus on here are the bottom lines for each scenario, which are the totals. So what we see on GRE is, at current levels of production and at a lower price, a gas revenue exclusion would involve not only the creation of a zeroing out all Cook Inlet gas taxes, but in fact there would be a large number of loss carryforwards available that could be applied to other areas of the state or carried forward for better, more firm pricing. If we move in the GRE numbers, the left-hand side of columns, the 450, the second scenario there, what you will see is that this tends to reflect about the world we see today. But even at that case, a two-thirds gas revenue exclusion would have left taxpayers in Cook Inlet generally with no tax and a small amount of credit that could be applied elsewhere. The current taxes are about $35 million in the Cook Inlet, and so you would have had a net drop from the current of about $40 million. Not only would Cook Inlet taxes have gone to zero on gas, but we would have seen the rest of the value carved out of the North Slope. As we go to higher prices, $6.50 and $8.50, what you will see is with a gas revenue exclusion, you would have tend to have had positive taxes, but it would have taken a value of about $8.50 to get the same collections that we have today under the status quo. So $8.50 is about the break even using the two-thirds gas revenue exclusion. Moving on to the middle column, the middle set of figures, and this is in fact the test that's looking. It's the test that you find in 011I. And what that says is, and what I'd like to do is skip down to the middle column, if you will, or the middle row, the $4.50. And what you will see is that under prices that look about the same as the prices that will show up in the capping test, the tax that is paid is about $21 million. And the difference between that and the status quo will be the application of the credits. So if you look over in the column that says change from current for 450 for the look back test, what you will see is exactly the numbers, the estimates that I used for the capital credits. What's going to happen again at current prices, with the L staying roughly constant, you will see that taxes are about the same as they are, as they would be if this bill hadn't passed, except now the credits are still available. So, to sum this up, we're not really, if prices stay constant, we're not really changing the tax rates. What we are doing, though, is building in incentives for further production. So a taxpayer is going to be held to roughly the same taxes they pay today, but if they are making investments, they can lower their taxes even further. If they don't make those investments, their taxes will stay about the same, and what the cap says is their taxes essentially won't be going up. If you look at as prices increase, what you will see is the effect of the cap, and so the tax is going to stay at roughly $21 million. And as prices go up, you simply will not see any tax increase. And what you will see is you will see the dollars, you know, the change from the PPT base or the change from current taxation, that delta becoming ever larger. But what this does, the look-back test is basically frees us on the values and the else we see today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And until you tell us otherwise, we're still under a GRE world. We're in this second, or did we?
through the chair. No,
I apologize. Okay. Each of these are three separate tests.
Right. Okay.
So where the look back test applies, this is as the statute, as the CS exists before you, right. And so there is no GRE.
Thank you.
What would happen, Representative Kelly, if I might, is if you look over in the column, the tax column under the GRE, you will see that the number, obviously at 250 and 450, it's a negative number, so the cap would never kick in. At $6.50, you might be just flirting with the cap, but probably you'd still be paying less. The cap would not kick in if you had a GRE until you had gas prices of $8.50.
About twice what they are now.
About twice what they are now.
Thank you.
The last column, or the last set of three columns, shows the effect of the $12 million credit. And once again, what I did here was this was based on the Senate bill, so not the CS. So this shows a $12 million credit being available to a big volume high elf producer. In fact, some of those folks are part of the folks that would be disqualified from taking the credit. But this is just looking at Cook Inlet and says, what happens as a consequence if all this credit was applied in Cook Inlet? What you see is, at low prices, the application of the credit would simply bring everybody to zero, and then they could take their investment credits and use them. As prices rise, and the credit were the only mechanism used to control Cook Inlet taxes, what you will see is the taxes will also continue to rise. And at an $8.50 price, you can see that the taxes collected would be like $180 million.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
They would only be reduced by the amount of the available credits, which would be, for the largest producers, $12 million, and for the smallest, something roughly half that. So if folks are looking at maintaining sort of current tax rates within the Cook Inlet, I think you can look at the $12 million credit and say that does not do that. That allows, as prices would go up, so too would the taxes reflect that price increase. It would reflect it quite as directly as without the credit, but fundamentally it would not. It would allow prices to rise. The opposite, the GRE does the same thing. It also allows taxes to rise with higher prices. What it does do is it sets that process so that it only happens at the highest of prices. In other words, the hurdle that has to be overcome is much, much larger. So, Mr. Chairman, I would love to spend time and walk through this and how this was calculated, but I'm sure if folks have specific questions, they can see me or ask me about the spreadsheet.
Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, Mr. Dickinson, just a 30,000-foot view here. Where does the difference between the capped amount and the amount that we would get without the cap and just the $12 million credit go? Does that relate to more money being put in the fields? Maybe.
To the chair. Part of the question, I'll get to that. What we have made sure, and I'll go through the outline in the front, is that it doesn't get added on top of certain kinds of credits. In other words, the cooking and the credits get used up, and it's a way of channeling how those credits get used, but in general, especially at higher prices, they will simply collect less revenues on cooking this gas than it would have otherwise.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up with that. What is the thinking of why you would treat a statewide owned resource by all of the people of Alaska differently in one area of the state than another area of the state? Can you give me the analysis of that and why we would have a reduction in the value, if you will, of the gas in Cook Inlet versus the value of the gas in Reggie Jewell's, Representative Jewell's area? Why would we do that?
Representative Holm, through the chair, I think there are two ideas that have come together in Cook Inlet. The first one is, if you look at the life cycles, I think you see that Cook Inlet is much, much more mature, much further advanced than the North Slope. The kinds of investment that are still being incented, and I think it's important that they are there in the look back test, are much smaller in magnitude and are sort of more of an incremental type of investment. And so I think what folks are looking at is the Cook Inlet as a very mature province in which we're basically trying to arrest the level, arrest what's in rather rapid decline. Some platforms are already shut in, things are occurring there. And I think the notion is the level of taxation represented by the 2020 may not line up with the amount of risk being taken in keeping those open, or what could happen to future production there. The second piece that I think is important is that, in general, the gas that is in Cook Inlet goes for many uses. Some of them are industrial uses on the Kenai Peninsula. Some of them are for consumption, just straight out generation of electricity, or even just home heating. But they are generally used in the state and are part of sort of the economic picture that branches out into many other areas of the economy. As you're probably aware, severance taxes are typically passed on through the consumers and make some of those processes more expensive. So I think contrasting that with the North Slope, where the gas that is used or the processes that are there are generally used only for export. Clearly there are some refineries in state, but the vast majority of those barrels are going out of state, and the gas that is used is used to support those operations. So I think those are the two differences between Cook Inlet and why there's a set of rules for Cook Inlet and why there's a separate set of rules for the North Slope.
Can I follow up? Where's any
Let's set gas across to the side. What can you make that same argument for oil? And the reason I ask you to make that same argument for oil is because most of the state does not use conventional natural gas. Most of the area of the state, not that particular area. So is it reasonable to assume that it's okay to raise the price on oil through the PPT process, which is consumed by all the other areas of the state, and give a benefit to the areas that just use natural gas within the state?
Representative Holm, through the chair, I think under this bill, this talks about the section I look back, which is referring to gas, but section J in the CS does the same thing for oil. And so you would find Cook Inlet oil has not paid any production tax for a number of years, and this would essentially lock that in. I think the important distinction an important distinction here is that the refining of oil within the Cook Inlet. Let me back up. Interestingly, a North Slope barrel and Cook Inlet barrel have about the same amount of cost associated with it. The Cook Inlet barrel, it's all upstream cost. It's production. I mean, it can literally cost you $15 to get a barrel of oil out of the ground. There's one platform I know that I had a chance to visit recently where I think it said 96% of the fluid coming through that was water.
Yeah.
It's a huge water plant that you're able to get some gas out of. Excuse me, get some oil and gas out of. So the costs there are upstream. They're reflected in this. The costs of getting that same barrel to Los Angeles, the four or five additional dollars that you spend on taps or on the tanker, get out of oil, you end up with the same kinds of constraints. So I guess as I would view this, we're doing the same thing for oil, even though, again, most of that oil is consumed within the refineries in the Cook Inlet area.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up. That did not answer my question. My question is, the refineries in the interior of Alaska refine oil, are based, their cost for refining, hence the cost that they sell for, are translated back to the state vis-a-vis what the Los Angeles price or whatever, so that you cannot lower the price of oil sold in the interior of Alaska or in other places of Alaska that buy oil from those refineries at any reduced level based upon any kind of a reduction or a cap in the tax on that oil. We don't have that in this. So the only oil that's taxed capped would be the oil that's taxed capped in Cook Inlet. And hence what happens in the long run is that you would have, of course, a better price. Theoretically, you'd have a better price in one area of the state, a better price in another area of the state. But my point is that the value of the gas and the oil to all of the people of the state of Alaska has not changed. And so you're applying different taxations for the purpose of benefiting one area of the state and not another area of the state, which is perfectly fine if you choose to do so. But I'd like to be pointed out that it really does impact when the PPT is implemented. It really does impact one area of the state or many areas of the state differently than it does Cook Inlet.
I hope I don't misspeak on this, and I may be a little bit out of date, but at least I believe that the oil contracts do not typically have a reimbursement for severance tax provision, whereas gas does. So in that sense, the effect of the energy costs of changing the tax rate may not flow through to what refineries do that are taking gas oil off of taps, for example. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Thank you.
And Representative Holm, I'd like to make one comment kind of on the lines that you're talking about as far as actual consumer pricing. We have the same similar problem you have in North Pole. You have a refinery. We have a refinery in McKiskey. But a half a mile from the refinery, our gas prices are higher to the consumer than they are in Anchorage or in a lot of other areas of the state. So it doesn't really translate down to the consumer at that level, I don't think, as far as what we're looking at now. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, on the Cook Inlet gas, I feel a little like the Manchurian candidate. Every time I sit down beside Representative Roachberg each day, he always whispers, "You're going to help me kill Cook Inlet tax." So each day he... kidding, though. But one of the problems of this is we were going to freeze it, right? That's what the intent was. Then we got the GRE. We were going to freeze it on a look back. We weren't going higher.
Very important. We're going to cap it, which is very different from freezing.
Yeah, cap. Okay. But when we look at what is happening in this middle, if you go to the 450 value, which is the closest thing you have to the current value, and the middle column, which is the current CS in front of us, we're at 21 million. We're at 35 now. Talk to me about how that's achieving what we set out to achieve. Because the other thing is that GRE that we would get rid of in this bill had the unintended consequence of a zero Cook Inlet tax rate, if I read you correctly before, and if what I've learned along the trail is true. That was an unintended consequence. Am I looking at another one here that's about a $14 million unintended consequence? In other words, we came from 36 down to 21, or am I reading this wrong?
Representative Kelly, through the chair. No, that is correct. And the difference is, again, if you look at the box, the intersection between the 450 set of rows and the change from current columns, the difference is the tax credits. So what we try to do here is maintain the system that says if you are investing, you can use those investments to lower your tax. If you are putting in investments for new production or expanding the ability or keeping a platform to continue to produce, those credits are going to be available in Cook Inlet to lower the taxes you pay in Cook Inlet. What they will not be available for, and that's what I'll walk through, and I think Robin already walked through once, and probably Jared's walking through a couple of times, is they will not be available to lower the taxes that are available or paid on other parts of the state. So they, essentially, we're ring-fencing the Cook Inlet operation and saying, we're going to put a cap on the taxes, and then you can take your investments and use those investments to reduce those taxes even further, but you can't reduce them down to below zero and then net them out against something that's happening in the rest of the state. But you're absolutely right. The difference between those is the investment level. If investment falls in Cook Inlet, then this number will increase. If investment increases in Cook Inlet, then that number would fall further.
Mm-hmm.
thing.
More through all of it?
Well, yeah. Every time we take a cut at this, and it's complicated, I appreciate that. But it, that...
If I might follow on with
it. Let's just say we left the elf in place on Cook Inlet, and we capped that. What would that center column look like then? At 450 gas.
Yeah, Representative Kelly, through the chair, I believe you would see it declining slowly over time with as the elf, if you mean just left the elf in place, correct. I believe that what you will see is, for example, the credits that have been extended for exploration in the Cook Inlet were at a different level than those. And so there's various things been done to try to arrest the sort of final stages, as I've described to Volk's question, of the sort of final maturity. I mean, the technical alternative that you could do is you could say, gee, yeah, absorb all your credits, and then we'll apply this test, and if there's anything left, then that has to be paid. I think our focus was that we believe that the incentives, the 20% incentive, is an important one, and it will work to increase the production. As a consequence, if that's on state land, we'll still be getting royalty, we'll still be getting income tax, we'll still be getting production tax, property taxes, all those things as a consequence. So, I guess the argument is we believe that the incentive for investment should still apply. And if you said you have to take all your credits and then we'll apply this test, essentially there would be no incentive for, we wouldn't be taking that incentivizing tool and using it in Cook Inlet.
Just one last, I promise. This would be a profits-based tax, so we've got to be making money to pay it. We're giving them the credits. So we have a double dip. We cap it, and then we let the credits actually take us negative. If in fact that worked out that way, as your GRE column proposes, and all you have to do to wipe out GRE is triple value, right? I mean, essentially, then we've got the same sort of a built-in difficulty. And I'm not. I mean, hearing each day in my ear about taking care of Cook Inlet here, I'm trying to get there, and I'm sitting beside a guy that isn't, and I'm just trying to figure this one out, because we've had several of these things that didn't play out the way I had thought they were, and I've been watching it fairly closely. So I'm done, Mr. Chairman. I'll think about it in the
future. Kelly, through the chair, I think the important thing to look at is the two columns. What you've done is a different balance. And what the look back does is, at lower prices, you are going to generate more tax than you would under the GRE. And there comes a point, a crossover point in the, I can't do the math here in my head, but it's in the $7 range or something, where the look back starts to generate less and the GRE starts to generate more. And yeah. So you've moved those particular things and where those lines cross.
The difficulty I'm having with it is we did a couple of the consequences of the GRE, which was to significantly move out the little guy line. You weren't a little guy. You were a little guy forever under that thing. That was one thing that I did not anticipate. And of course, the second thing, is the fact that we ended up with a negative tax. Nobody was talking about that actually being a bottom line result until we had a chance to stew in this and look at it and study it a bit. Here we are making another change that, you're right, is leagues in the right direction, because it gets some money at the current price, but it immediately involves a discount of about 11, 14 million. I forget what the head of the money was. 16 million, and then applies credits to it. And I'm a little worried that we're double dipping here more than, and that gets us to a greater discount than we had anticipated. Better than the other one was, at GRE, which we tried to improve, and that didn't turn out to be very effective. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I'll dog it off there, and I'll just keep watching, taking a look at it.
I'll represent the water.
Nice. One comment on Representative Kelly. I've always found Representative Roper to be the warmest, kindest, most compassionate, bravest legislator I've ever met.
I have.
I have as well.
Thank you, Raymond.
Wonder what bill's coming up for rules.
Your camera.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, if I might just to go to the front sheet of this and just walk through for a second time sort of how I and Jay work. Again, I want to focus in on two observations. One of them is this test is for 15 years. It just runs through 2021. And the second thing is that we are, current taxes, I think, as I've said, are about $34 million. So we are... spending, we're setting up a lot of rules to deal with a very small piece. There are other changes that are made on the North Slope that have much, much larger effects than this, but may simply appear to be a change of a word or two. So, what happening in Cook Inlet? Let's again just focus on Cook Inlet gas, existing production. You'll have the PPT as normal, a 20% tax rate, but then you do a comparison under 011I. And that comparison is you look back for a period that ended April 1st, 2005 through March 31st, 2006. You look at that one-year period. You look at the ELF on a lease-by-lease basis, or a leasehold property basis, and you find out what that ELF is. And so, as I said, it'll average about 0.5, but for existing production, it'll be what it actually was for that property. The price will be the prevailing value that we've published, so that will not vary. That will be the single value applied to all leases. And you're going to set a ceiling on a lease for property basis. So once you've set that ceiling is essentially on a per-unit basis, and the only gross dollar increase that can occur can come from increased volumes.
Once you've figured out whether you're using the PPT unvarnished or the 11i ceiling, you can then come and deduct your credits. However, it can only take the Cook Inlet taxes to zero, and it cannot be used outside of the Cook Inlet, sold, transferred, anything used against other parts of the state, unless those credits would have been available under the PPT. So we're basically doing a double test there. So, for example, if you made a huge investment and prices were low, and those credits would have been available to you anyway, even without the test, you can still treat them just like you would a normal statewide credit. New gas production is going to be subject essentially to the same test. Again, you calculate the PPT at 20%. You make this 11i comparison. This is under, I think, B. But now you're looking at the same comparison period, but now what you're doing is you're taking all other production. You're taking the average ELF that existed, not looking at any specific lease or property, but just the average ELF, and that will be applied to any new unit coming on. The price, again, will be that same PV, and so you will now try again on a new unit by unit basis. You will now set a cap or stay where you were. And you have the same rules applying there. Once you set it either at the PPT rate or under the ceiling rate, any credits that were generated, if you have a new production, you probably will have some credits because you'll have the cost to develop that. Those are also going to be, I shouldn't say deductible, it would be creditable, probably be a better word, very imprecise there. But again, they can only be used to take your tax in Cook Inlet to zero. Cannot be used, sold, transferred otherwise, unless they would have been available under the PPT anyway. Cook Inlet oil is going to be under the same scheme. We've built the same words in. But I think the important point to recognize, and I think it does, there hasn't been a positive ELF for Cook Inlet oil for over a decade now. And so that you'll simply plug a zero in, and once you plug a zero into a series of multiplicative terms, it really doesn't matter what the PV or anything of those are. You simply will remain at zero for the period. And so again, credits would only be available if you would have gotten those same credits under the PPT without any additional application. So primarily the credits
are going to adhere to the gas side. And I think the last point is very important here. It says department will write regulations to allocate costs between Cook Inlet and the rest of the state. But once you're within Cook Inlet, typically the work there on the platform, you're going to have oil, you're going to have gas. Those will be applied against your production operations in the Cook Inlet. So I hope that's a summary that says where we are, and the backup numbers here explain why the GRE, if you've got this tool in place, you do not need the GRE to get you to the same or even a similar place, because it would have done the job twice. And that, Mr. Chairman, is my presentation based on what I saw at 7:30 this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, if you applied this to Cook Inlet but took the cap off, what would that center column do for the next 5 years that's now $21 million? And on a netted basis, I mean, I don't want to ambush you with that question, but you have a feel for that?
Sure, Representative Kelly, through the chair. If you turn to the second, to the page, the backup page, what you will see in the very right-hand column is simply what the taxes would be in Cook Inlet if you made the assumption that the credits simply applied again. I mean, sort of thought of it as that you didn't technically ring-fence it, but you just looked at the dollars and the barrels that are flowing, the MCF that are flowing in Cook Inlet. So what you can see is, and that compares, if you will, with the fourth column over, which shows the current tax. I think what you will see is the current tax is always less than the PPT. If the one thing this doesn't have in here is the $12 million credit, so for example, at low prices, you might in fact have less under the PPT than you do under current if enough producers apply that standalone $12 million credit to their PPT, to their Cook Inlet production. But as you can see, when it's based on profitability, if you assume the costs stay the same, you soon get much higher taxes.
111.
On the very last column, for example, at $8.50, you would have a quarter, close to $200 million in gas taxes coming from Cook Inlet under the PPT, whereas you would only have about $70 million under the current tax.
And the 95
at 450 current value.
Correct. And one of the things, this does not include any kick from progressivity. This is just in the base of 60
cents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Petula.
Yeah, so you still get to roll the credits forward. You can't go down to zero, but they get to take them in the out years on this.
Representative Petula, through the chair, I believe that's correct, as long as they stay within Cook Inlet. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petula, if I could just expand on that. To the extent that the credits are otherwise allowed to be carried forward, now, for example, the $12 million credit is not allowed to be carried forward to future years.
Right. And there's no time limit on that? I mean, so there isn't any time limit on the rolling forward of these credits? I can't remember which one we limited now, but...
That's correct. I mean, there's no time limit in general, and the Cook Inlet provisions don't add a time limit that wasn't there.
Thank you.
Any other questions today?
Did you?
No. Wasn't I Representative Holmes?
I have a general question, okay. But I don't know, is this the time to go ahead and ask? I don't know who's going to answer. Okay. Have you guys analyzed what happens under this scenario to Point Thompson and how much the state would pay or give it back, how much it would cost the state under the deductions and the credits under this scenario, under this bill? Any rough estimates?
agree that we've seen figures of, several billion-dollar investment. You can just translate that and say it would be roughly 20% of that. And then operating costs, once you build the operating in, that would be another 20% of the production costs, and then the capital included in that. So I think it would certainly be a major development. It's the one major development we see on the horizon that's going to be costing those kind of dollars in the upstream, and so it would be the same percentages.
And under the look back, if the level of investment remains the same that it was last year, any estimates on how much that's going to cost the state? Have you looked at that at all yet?
Representative Curtula, through the chair, again, we haven't gone in and parsed exactly. There are some general investment figures that suggest that over that time period, there was roughly $5 billion, without notions expressed. And so you would simply look at 20% of that, and that is about $1 billion.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that point that was couched in the context of what is it going to cost the state, does that not also have to be viewed in view of the light of this bill? Doesn't this have to be, or that so-called cost, that which effect is the credits related to the expenditures on that development, doesn't that have to be considered in the context of a very significant increase in the base tax levels? It's a buyback of increased taxes. Does not this bill, not counting those credits, substantially, massively increase the taxes that would be paid on existing production?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, that's correct. The way that cost would be, the way the state would fund that cost is through the higher tax. So it is a deduction from an increase. But you're absolutely correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hawker.
If I might, just as the editorial statement would like to emphasize, let there be no mistake. This is a massive increase in taxes, is what we have in front of us.
Any other questions of Dan?
Well, overall, have you done any figures to show us whether or not we're going to make more or less after all the deductions and the credits under the current system or under this bill? I mean, we don't really know, do we?
Representative Curtula, through the chair, we actually have, and I've got the binder here of all the presentations we've made, and there are, we've done many of those, and we can certainly recap those. This particular CS, you're correct, we have not done that for, but the changes in that relative. I think the important point to emphasize is, at current prices, it is a massive increase. As prices fall, the increase gets less, and at a range of prices which we did see for a period in the 80s, in fact, would be a tax decrease.
Thank you.
Any other questions of our three panel? Seeing none, thanks. Robin, go ahead.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman. Earlier there was a question raised about total taxes brought in regarding progressivity. If you'll recall, we had produced a chart that had said progressivity surcharge, and I believe Co-Chair Meyer questioned then total taxes. So while we were here in this room, our economist ran out and ran some draft. I would like to emphasize draft numbers. And so you have a new chart in front of you, and it does say ADR at the bottom, draft. And this chart is different in that it talks about severance tax per barrel. And compare that to the old chart that you had before you. And the other thing I would like to point out is just a caution. On the new chart, we have three lines, as we did on the old one. The CS before you is represented by the yellow line that is a 20% tax rate with a slope of 1.75 on net 45. So that's the CS. The red line is a 22.5% tax rate with a slope of 0.1% on net 35. So that's representative of the Senate bill. I would caution you, however, the blue line is not at the tax rate that was the house that came out of the house. So I would just caution you that the blue line is 20% tax rate with a 0.25 slope on net 35. So the progressivity matches the old house bill. The basic tax rate is slightly lower. And so what we see here, then your question, Senator Meyer, had to do at $70 oil.
Right.
We see that the current CS would bring in about, it looks like roughly $11 per barrel total tax. The Senate CS looks like about 12, and then the other version, the other scenario here, looks like 12.50. That again, that's not the House version, it's slightly less. But this does, I think, give you some sort of order of magnitude on that. Did you have something further?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might add, we'll also correct that so that you see it in the context of the bill. Just doing a calculation off the top of my head, which is also dangerous, but it does respond to Representative Petula's current point. I believe if you plotted the current data, what we would get under the status quo, you would get at $70 would be a figure of $4.90. So I think you can see the order of magnitude of the change. And I'll check that as well before the next meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other thing on the original chart that you showed us.
I know you always start at $50.
And my assumption is at $50, if are we to assume that somewhere around here that it's $15 per barrel to produce or to lift and exclusive of corporate tax, royalty tax, etc. What's the number we're supposed to kind of infer from this chart?
Representative Holmes, to the chair, I think that's right. If you look at the period 2006 through 2030, I think that you will see that that's that is the
number
of the average figure that's pushed through there.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you. It's my intent now to any of the committee members have any other questions? It's my intent now to recess to a call of the chair, probably somewhere around 4 o'clock or 5. I'd like to come back and start addressing amendments, and we'll work from there. So why don't we look at coming back at 5? Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, regarding the amendments, since that's a relatively short time to absorb this, you're not saying all amendments have to be in by 4 or 5?
No, all of them had to be in by 10 o'clock this morning.
Yeah. No, but I mean, if stuff comes up.
No, and I think we realize that some of these issues will probably will have a battle elsewhere, maybe here, but elsewhere also, and so, you know, I want to hear the amendments. We'll look at them, see if we can incorporate them, see what effect they have, and if not, then we know that there's always the other avenue on the floor to introduce other amendments. So with that, I'd like to thank the committee for being here. Thank you, Dan, Robin, and Rob. And I'll recess the meeting till 5 o'clock. Good afternoon, and welcome back to House Finance. this afternoon's schedule
Good afternoon and welcome back to House Finance. this afternoon's schedule we'll take up amendments, but after we have a little presentation on Cook Inlet. There were some issues earlier regarding Cook Inlet and what the changes actually meant. So I think Dan's tried to break it down a little bit and put it in English so we can maybe understand it. Also, there was a question earlier about some of Pedro Van Meer's thoughts that he sent out in an email that I got, I think it was the 31st. We've asked the administration to try to get Pedro here. He can't be here tonight, but they're checking to see if he could be here in the morning, or, you know, teleconference in the morning and try to answer any questions there. So, right now, it's the intent to take up Cook Inlet. Then we will look at amendments. It's not my intent tonight to pass this out. There's a couple of amendments that one of the member has that I need to look at and talk with him some more about. So with that, Dan, if you'd like to speak to Cook Inlet issues and what the changes made, then we
Mr.
can.
Chairman, I thought I'd try to make it clear, so I'm going to turn it over to Robin.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, my name is Robin Wilson. I'm the director of the Tax Division. And what I've done is prepare a couple of example sheets, which you should have there before you. And so I'd like to just march through the examples one by one. And so I'm looking first at example A1. This addresses Cook Inlet Gas, because that really is where the potential tax is. And so what we start with is sort of a tentative tax calculation. In the big picture, is we compare the tax under the PPT with the tax under the ELF before credit. And so that's the overall goal of this calculation. So the heading says tentative tax. And so we start out that the PPT tax before credit, in example A1, is $100 million. Base credit then is applied first because it is not transferable and can't be carried forward. And in this example, all production of this producer is in the Cook Inlet. So from the $100 tax, then the tentative calculation shows the base credit being removed of 12. And in this example, I've assumed CapEx credit of 110. Now that is more than the tentative tax in this example, so that's why CapEx credits usable are 88, which brings the tentative tax down to zero then. And so then we look at what is the ELF tax before credit. That's item B. And in this example, the ELF tax before credit is 95. So then the test asks us to pick the lower of those two tentative taxes. And in this case, it would be 95 instead of 100. So in this example, then, the tax benefit enjoyed is 5. Okay, so then, what is the actual tax calculation? And this, I've labeled it tax calculation. You take the lower of, which in this example is 95. We apply the base credit of 12. And then, in this example, then, the amount of credits we can use there is 83 because the tax is lower. So then in dealing with our credits, we've used 83 actually, but then we also enjoyed a tax benefit of 5, and that is, I'll refer you back up, that's item Y. And so, in looking at our credit, then, the 5 is deemed to have been used from the credits. And so, the total CapEx credits deemed to have been used is a total of the 83 actually used plus the 5 deemed to be used, so it's a total of 88.